I'm Christopher Lighton with the novelist Thomas Mallon, who has brought the dark side of Richard Nixon to light as never before, I think, in a book called Watergate, coming up on the 40th anniversary of the third-rate burglary that ended a presidency. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, about a political gem of a book. And I take it personally because I wrote about a lot of these characters myself in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times a long time ago. But it dazzles me that these players are livelier in fiction than they were in memory, or maybe in life. Thomas Mallon, you have vindicated Henry James's conviction that it is art that makes life, makes interest, makes importance. Henry James thought there was no substitute whatever for the force and beauty of art's process, which is pretty much my feeling for what you've done here. What was it you set out to do, especially for those millions of people now who have no memory of Watergate?
Well, Nixon, I think I was building up to write about him for decades. He was the most dominant public figure in my life, and I thought for a while I might write about him in nonfiction. I had an editor who was sort of pushing me a little bit in that direction, and I can't tell you how it finally occurred to me. I just remember one night, I live across the street from the Watergate in Washington, and I was walking down 8th Street between my office at George Washington University and my house, and I just looked at the building, and it occurred to me, I'm going to do a novel about Watergate. I've subsequently found in some interview I gave years ago that I said, somebody could make a good novel out of Watergate. So clearly the idea was, it was somewhere in my mind. But I'd been writing a lot about American historical events in fiction, and I tend to approach them from bystanders, you know, at a somewhat oblique angle, from the minor characters. My novel about the Lincoln assassination was a book called Henry and Clara, and it was all about the couple who were in the balcony with the Lincolns on that night. So the people who are the point of view characters in this book, many of them they're well-known people. Pat Nixon, she was the first lady, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, but they were not central players in the Watergate drama. Nixon, I do get into as well, but so it's a combination of these peripheral and central figures. This is the only book I think I've ever written where I wished there had been less source material. You talk about open source, I mean, it's just, I mean, everything. They all wrote memoirs, sometimes just to pay their legal bills. There were the committee transcripts from the investigation. There were the White House tapes, whatever. It's an enormous morass of material, but I wanted somehow not to be a scholar of it, but to somehow make it intimate and somehow see what it must have been like to live through it personally and to try to imagine the people as they went through it, remembering, this is me remembering, that they don't know how it's going to turn out. You know, we can't see it turning out any other way now. I mean, Nixon resigns August of 74, but he didn't know that he wasn't going to survive until the very end. And so it's very important to, I think in writing fiction, maybe historians would say the same thing, but it's very important to get rid of the things that you know and that the principals, the characters, don't yet know if you're going to try to get into their minds and try to imagine how they were feeling it moment by moment.
I remember thinking 40 years ago, almost, it's going to take a novelist to figure this thing out. And I'm saying to my wife, and every reporter in Washington was obsessed with this whole story and various little pieces of it, it's incomprehensible. Not only why they did it and who authorized it, who was responsible, who should be responsible, was it a political act, was it a criminal act? I remember saying, no, it's hopeless. But one day a novelist will come along and suddenly it's you. And you've nailed it in so many ways we've got to talk about. We'll get to Nixon, who is, of course, the central piece, but there are other big themes that come through in the book. For one thing, politics as kind of gang warfare, which it probably always was and maybe inevitably is. Also, politics as the organization of hatreds. Everybody in this book hates somebody else,
right,
whether it's Alice Longworth hating Kay Graham and the Washington Post, or the press hating Nixon, or Kissinger sort of looking down on everybody, or Rose Woods hating Haldeman. Speak to the general point of the hatred that makes this whole network fire.
mostly what you have in the book are people hating their allies, people hating not their enemies, you know, on the left, not their enemies in the press, not their enemies in the Democratic Party, but the rivalries within the Nixon administration were intense and very personal, sometimes very raw. I think that's probably true of most administrations. But that's one of the things that drives everybody, those internal rivalries, as well as the, you know, extramural ones. And in Nixon's case, I think what did him in, what was fatal to him, has to do with just what you're talking about, with hatred and so forth. He had the worship of toughness. He loved tough guys. And so much of what is really repellent about Nixon, and I find a lot also to admire in Nixon. I wouldn't have wanted to write a novel about a cardboard villain, you know, some mustache-twirling, melodramatic figure. But when Nixon is at his worst, I see him being driven always by the worship of toughness. Even the horrible things on the tapes, like his anti-Semitism, the racism, these crude expressions, what he himself referred to David Frost as our gangster language that you hear on the tapes, to him, I don't think these hatreds actually ran all that deep, and these prejudices ran all that deep, but the expression of them was a kind of locker room talk to him. And he's often really at his worst when he's trying to fuel himself with that very hatred. People always ask me now, you know, do you think he knew about the break-in in advance? And I think it's almost impossible. If you can prove a negative, you almost can. If you listen to him on the tapes, there's nothing he says that indicates he could have had foreknowledge of it. All of his questions and so forth indicate otherwise. But what I hear when he's talking about it and when he is covering it up and when he is conspiring is not a man who's trying to show that he knew less about the whole thing than he did, but trying to show that he knew more, because he's always talking to his Confederates like Haldeman and Ehrlichman and whatever, and half the time Nixon doesn't remember who did what over at the committee to reelect. You know, that was all, as they would say in the government, down in the weeds. He didn't know those details, but he's trying to show that he's on top of it. Oh, well, of course, yeah. Oh, Hunt. I mean Hunt, you know, not Liddy. That sort of thing. And so in a way, he's sort of inculpating himself instead of exculpating himself.
To be one of the boys, in effect.
Yes, very much.
Speak a little bit about the rivalries. I'm fascinated that he loved John Mitchell, as you say, and there was a tough guy thing there. He loved the fact that Mitchell had been a hockey player. He also loved the guy that Mitchell hated, Chuck Colson, who was just a kind of rat, a professional rat, mean, dirty tricks kind of guy. Mitchell said he was that Colson was a compendium of Richard Nixon's worst instincts. But he also loved to drink with Henry Kissinger. These were his late-night drinking buddies, totally different characters, and all with a lively disdain for each other. How does this work?
Well, I think he sort of unconsciously at least plays them off one against the other. And they do represent different sides of him. Kissinger represents the visionary side. One of the things that I think made it hard for him to get rid of the tapes at the last possible moment when he could have, he probably still would have been indicted for doing that. But before they were actually under subpoena, is there's some speculation, I think, in Haldeman's diaries that he knew that anybody who listened to the tapes in later years would have to conclude that he himself was the architect of his grand foreign policy and that Kissinger was the instrument through which it was carried out, rather than vice versa, as some people argued at the time. And it's interesting, in the days just after the break-in, practically everybody in the White House thought this just feels like it's got Colson all over it. It's got to be Colson operation. He's got to be the one who sent them in there. To this day, we don't know exactly who sent them into that particular target at that particular time. I mean, we do know that they had this espionage plan in place. Gordon Liddy had stood up in John Mitchell's office in the Justice Department and laid it out on an easel. But what were they looking for in the DNC is a whole other question. But I think that quote about Colson being this sort of stew of Nixon's dark impulses, I do think there's a lot of truth to that. If you look at Nixon's daily schedule, he loved nothing better than to end the day with a call to Colson.
Absolutely.
It was where he could let it all hang out.
Speak to the point that the book makes in different ways, that the whole thing is about a political drive to self-destruction. I mean, Howard Hunt left an envelope with minor check to his country club in the Howard Johnson's hotel, which gave him away originally. John Mitchell, of course, should have stopped the conversation when Liddy immediately, mm-hmm. Brought up the idea of the break-in. Nixon could have stopped it at many times. There is this sense of people setting their own traps.
Right.
All through the book, all through life, maybe. But what is that in politics?
I think this is where being a novelist really comes in, because Hunt did leave behind this check, $6.36, paid to his own country club. He forgot to mail it, and when the burglars were caught, he and Liddy had to scoot out of the room in the hotel. And to me, I, without any absolute evidence, but just the instincts of a novelist, I went on the, there are no accidents theory, that on some level he wanted to accelerate his own capture, his own implication in this. The human factor, I think, is always enormous. Nixon, to some extent, blamed the whole thing on Martha Mitchell, who was John Mitchell's flamboyant, alcoholic, very quotable wife. She was a tremendous character in those days. She was one of the only colorful characters in the Nixon administration, which was a pretty bland corporate bunch of guys. But Mrs. Mitchell had tremendous drinking problem, and she was getting much, much worse. And John Mitchell, it was a second marriage for both of them. John Mitchell loved Martha Mitchell. It was a love match. It really was. And he was tormented by Martha's troubles, and she was at a point where, she needed to dry out. She was going in for treatment. And Nixon blamed Martha. He couldn't bear to blame Mitchell himself. He owed so much to Mitchell. Mitchell had managed his campaign in 68. Mitchell, in many ways, had really made him president, had made the big comeback possible. But Nixon thought that Martha's problems were so distracting Mitchell in the spring of 72 that, he just wasn't really minding the store the way he might have. So all of those human factors, they interested me. And that was the kind of thing I wanted to write about more than, how the investigation unraveled, the cover-up and so forth. That's been done very well by any number of people.
Tom Mellon, it's the mind of the novelist that fascinates me, and how you made the leaps to language in these characters that sound so breathtakingly real, much more real than anything they would have wanted to be quoted on saying. We could talk all night about passages in this book. I want to know where the insights came from. Maybe letters, maybe diaries, maybe your own wildest imagination. For example, and there's so many, Richard Nixon in Moscow, just ruminating, and you're reading his mind in effect, but he's thinking about this business of the evil empire. And he says to himself, every left-wing professor had recoiled at seeing the word evil used to describe the Soviet Union, but had no trouble applying it twice a week to Richard Nixon.
This is Nixon at the end of the book, in an epilogue, when he's on one of the many trips he makes to the Soviet Union. And, this is just before his death, nearly 20 years after Watergate. And, he is talking about, the way when Reagan used that word for the Soviet Union, everybody piled on. But, it's Nixon, the aggrieved person, the sense that he's always the victim of a double standard and so forth. But it's also Nixon having a point to some extent. And it's also, in some ways, Nixon at his best. He was a model ex-president. He may have been terrible while in office in many ways. But when he was out of office, he wrote serious books. He did not take money for speeches. He offered his advice free to every president who followed him. That trip that I write about, he reports to Bill Clinton on it, and Bill Clinton remarks at Nixon's funeral that he went to some of his advisors, and he says, why aren't I getting memos this good from my own ambassadors and staffers? So in some ways, I think he served his country better when he was out of office than when he was in.
Take another completely different example. This is Rosemary Woods, who had danced with the senator from Massachusetts, Ed Brooke, and was just swept off her feet. She thought that was the greatest privilege of her dancing life. She goes, after he calls for Nixon's resignation, she goes and knocks on his apartment door. They're in the same building. She wanted to give her favorite dancing partner a piece of her mind. There was no risk of having his wife open the door. They'd been separated for years, but his TV reporter girlfriend might be there. We know now that was Barbara Walters. Brooke opens the door almost immediately in his shirt sleeves, with a drink in his hand. "Terpsichore," he cried in delighted surprise. He remembers her as a dancer, too. "I was just watching you on TV." She could see him noticing that she had yet to change her dress. And much worse, she could feel the horrible words that were rising to her lips. "You black bastard." She thanked God they didn't escape and hated herself for even thinking them, but she hated him more. She was so purple with rage that she couldn't get any words out. Brooke, slow to register her agitation, tried to mollify her. "Rose, come in for a glass of wine. I know you've had an awful day." She says, "You ought to drink alone. That way you can't stab anybody in the back."
You know, Ed Brooke, who is still alive, was the first African-American senator since Reconstruction. Richard Nixon had urged him to run for the Senate in 66, had campaigned for him. But as Watergate deteriorated, he was among the first to call for Nixon to resign. And Rosemary Woods, who had liked Ed Brooke and had, they were both very good dancers, and they both lived in the Watergate. They both lived in Watergate West. She was furious about this. And here again is history versus fiction. There was an incident. Somebody witnessed her chewing him out in the Watergate. Hmm. But the whole dialogue that they actually engage in, I have her going down the hall and, you know, banging on his door, is what is something I made up. But a detail that he supplied that never made it into the press at the time but made it into his memoirs, which only came out from some university press several years ago, was the next day after that incident, he went down to the Watergate garage, and he was something of a car nut, and he had this beautiful Mercedes that he was very proud of, and somebody had keyed the car, and there was this huge gash in it, and he said many years later in his memoir, you know, "I have no evidence of it, but I've never," something like, "I've never been able to convince myself that it was anybody but Rosemary," because she was so fierce about that. And, you know, Rosemary Woods, she was a working class Irish girl from Sebring, Ohio, whatever. And I could sort of imagine that in her anger toward Ed Brooke, the first thing that would rise up out of her was a racial epithet. You know, we all carry this baggage from upbringing and so forth. And that she, at the same time, would have felt ashamed as she felt it rising. And again, to try to see these things from the character's point of view, that whole chapter is really seen from her point of view.
You're great on the subject of Elliot Richardson, and I want to know where you got that stuff. But for example, you're there in Baltimore where Elliot Richardson is sealing the end of Spiro Agnew's career, in disgrace, of course. He explains in public why he didn't want Agnew prosecuted, to go to prison for these things. Disgrace was enough. Richardson, in the Baltimore court, gave three reasons why Agnew should be disgraced but not imprisoned. A, respect for the office of the vice presidency. B, human compassion. C, appreciation for Agnew's taking the deal and sparing the nation a lengthy trial on the charges at hand. And you write, three reasons, three lies. Richardson had no more respect for the vice presidency than he had for Spiro Agnew. Rarely, in fact, had a man and an office been so well matched, and the only person the bastard was sparing was himself, from certain conviction. I love this unveiling of what we all know to be phony political language.
Mm-hmm. Elliot Richardson badly wanted to be president of the United States, and nobody was more aware of that than Richard Nixon. And in that sense, for all of the ways in which he comes down to us as a heroic figure in Watergate, was also acting from ambition, the same as any other politician. He becomes a kind of comic, pompous figure in the book. I was surprised I poured it on to the extent I didn't. Somebody asked me about that recently, and I said, yeah, and that sort of surprised me. And I'm not a believer that characters take on a life of their own when you're writing about them. But I think part of that was, I mean, here we're talking in Boston, and I'm thinking about my 5 years across the river in Cambridge, and I think that was the Mick in me, the Irish in me, the residual sense of being kind of an Arab East, the way Nixon had it and the way Agnew surely had it. You know, I remember there were many, 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 many more Elliot Richardsons around 40 years ago. You know, they were still in some ways the heart and soul of a place like Harvard. And I wonder, am I You know, is that some of my scholarship student resentment coming out? Because I just found him to be sort of a windbag, and I wound up writing dialogue for him, and I'd sound it out. He had his teeth were always together, and he became a figure I liked writing dialogue for.
He could make anybody feel like an arabiste, like just off the boat and somehow unworthy. At the same time, you know, I wrote a lot about him at the time, and I found him enormously interesting in several dimensions. For one thing, he was a kind of child of Teddy Roosevelt. He had taken up boxing at Harvard, as Teddy Roosevelt did, this sort of patrician cult of toughness of his own. He had a great war record, but he was also a kind of cousin of Richard Nixon. He was a fundamentally awkward, socially impossible guy who was not cut out for street politics. But George Bundy had run for the Boston City, or been tried to run for the Boston City Council in that same generation, and couldn't abide the whole idea of it, dropped out very quickly. Eliot, for all his awkwardness, loved it. And I was on many campaign trails with him. I think of going to the Schraff's candy factory over there in Everett. He loved being there at 6:30 in the morning when working people were coming in. Yeah. They thought he was from the board of directors or something.
Yeah.
But he loved that. He paid in sort of sweat equity for a political career.
When I started the book, I had lists there somewhere still in my files still, where I made lists of, you know, dozens of characters who were possible point of view characters in the book. And I ultimately settled on 7. Some of that had to do with the ones that I felt when I started writing for them, writing dialogue for them, moving them around, trying to get inside their heads. I thought, oh, well, yeah, this one I have a feel for. Or this one, you know, I can plausibly make speech for them, whereas others didn't come into very sharp focus for me.
You've got his voice entirely. Anyway, there's a wonderful exchange in the book where after he gets Agnew out of the way, he's talking to Al Haig, who was on to the Richardson trick, and Richardson smiles to Haig before saying, with a kind of pained wistfulness, "Agnew didn't seem willing to shake my hand once it was over. I would have preferred things to end a little more civilly than they did." And Haig says, "Eliot, he didn't like shaking your hand before all that started."
Richardson and Haig, they had a terrible relationship from the time Richardson became the Attorney General, and Haig insisted always that there was a deal that Richardson was going to dismiss Archibald Cox, that Richardson had signed off on that, and there was a compromise for the tapes, and they were going to be, an agreement to give them in some redacted form had been achieved, and the whole constitutional crisis that was the Saturday Night Massacre was going to be averted. And in fact, he always maintains that Richardson reversed himself at the end and essentially broke a deal that they had. And I don't think that one can definitively come to any conclusions about that, but the little bit that again, it's so fortunate being a novelist instead of a historian, because you can conclude what you want to. But what I inferred from looking at Richardson's papers from the time and thinking about Richardson and his behavior, I think there probably was a deal, and I think that he probably did decide at the very last minute not to go with it.
I always wonder why he didn't force Nixon to fire him, why he resigned from the office of Attorney General rather than fire Archie Cox, and not say, "Mr. President, I can't fire Archibald Cox. I'm the Attorney General of the United States. Fire me if you must."
That I can't answer. They had a tremendously tense meeting just before it happened, Nixon and Richardson at the White House. Richardson describes this meeting in print, and he's described it for documentary filmmakers. And he was, you know, sort of quivering with anger when Nixon said, you have a very different idea of the national interest than I do. You know, and Elliot Richardson is sitting there, and he's a man who won the Bronze Star and whatever, and he's not going to be lectured to by Richard Nixon, who is in this thing up to his shoulders, you know, in this scandal. Which is to say, I don't think that there was an absence of principle on Richardson's part. I don't try to turn him into a villain, but I also think there was calculation, there was ambition, and Nixon recognized that. When Nixon makes him Attorney General, he calls him up on April 30th, 1973, after he's fired Haldeman and Ehrlichman, and He says, Elliot, he says, you know, this could take you all the way. And he knows that Richardson wants to be president. And then being Nixon, he tries to push his advantage a little bit. And he says, you know, Elliot, one thing, I'm not sure you're going to need a special prosecutor. And, of course, the special prosecutor became Archibald Cox. You know, and when you listen to that tape now and realize everything that was about to happen in the next several months, it's sort of chilling. And the minute he says that, Richardson pushes back a little bit. And he says, well, Mr. President, I'm not sure of that. He wants to leave that option open. And the last thing Nixon can afford at that moment is to annoy Richardson. He's just brought him in because he needs his Mr. Clean. He needs his Harvard man. He needs this man whose, you know, reputation is so strong. And so Nixon backs off that idea right away. And as soon as Richardson says, well, I may want to have a special prosecutor, Nixon said, you do whatever you want, my boy, and I'll back you to the hilt. You can dig up Charles Evans Hughes if you want.
So many other voices to take account of here, especially Alice Roosevelt Longworth. Lives into her 90s. She's a vital figure, but she also is credited by Nixon himself with having sort of made his career. He had befriended her when her daughter committed suicide, and he had kind of committed himself emotionally to her. Mm-hmm. And of course, she never forgot it. There's a moment in the book where she's reflecting on a visit he made to her house in the 50s, the darkest moment of her life. And then when he shouldered the coffin, she remembered the creased, naked expression on this darkest of dark horses, this misanthrope in a flesh presser's profession, able to succeed from cunning and a talent for denying reality at close range. She didn't share his general dinginess. She smiled in delight, however viciously, whereas he smiled only in a kind of animal desperation. But she shared the darkness beneath and the capacity for denial. She could sometimes change or negate reality just with her contempt for it. You've got Alice Roosevelt down, too.
Alice Roosevelt was a brilliant woman, very witty, very funny, very malicious. She was famous for having a pillow in her DuPont Circle mansion that said, if you can't say something nice about somebody, please come sit by me. And she was very sharp-tongued and caustic. But she had gotten to know the Nixons from the time he arrived in town in Washington in the 40s. She knew Nixon and Pat. She saw quite a lot of them. She was, as a very old lady in her late 80s, she was in and out of the Nixon White House much more often than I thought. And Nixon was still sort of cultivating Mrs. L, as everyone called her. She had a bad cold and couldn't make it, but there was a space reserved for her on the reviewing stand of the inaugural parade in 73. She was going to be the only person to sit with the Nixon family. He goes to her 90th birthday party in February of 1974. He and Mrs. Nixon, they go to her house. And it's a big affair as she turns 90. And Watergate is reaching its absolute climax. He's only months away from resignation. And there's, you know, tremendous tension in the house. And so that became a scene in the book, the party scene that I wrote. And I just pulled this out of the book. I had an email from somebody just a few days ago, somebody I don't know. And he wrote me and he says, I was at Alice Roosevelt's 90th birthday party in February of 1974. Sorry I didn't see you or President Nixon there. He says, in any case, when it was my turn to speak with her, such beautiful blue eyes, I told her there was a play at the Kennedy Center going on called Bully, and it was about her father. She said it sounded boring. She asked about the title, and I said, well, he was famous for saying bully whenever he was pleased with something. And she replied, nonsense, he never said any such thing. So, I mean, that's sort of how she talks in the book, too, and she was extremely sharp-tongued. But she liked and admired Nixon. She also was, deeply engaged in all of the coverage of Watergate. I mean, she's sort of the historical memory in the novel. She's kind of my one-woman witch's chorus, and she's seen it all. She remembers Teapot Dome and everything else, and she's the one when people start talking about we're the gravest crisis in the history of the Republic. You know, John Chancellor says something like that on the night of the Saturday Night Massacre, and Alice hears that, and who could remember legless Civil War veterans begging in the street, thought, nonsense. We have to go quite a ways before we get to the gravest constitutional crisis of the Republic if it's going to equal the Civil War. So she was in all kinds of fun to write dialogue for.
You have a scene in the book where she, through Rosemary Woods, finds a way to get with Nixon the night before he leaves the White House. And she not only bucks him up, but she gets Nixon to read a short passage from her father's diary on the death of Teddy Roosevelt's wife, a heartbreaking moment when Teddy Roosevelt said, "My heart's dearest died, and the light went from my life forever." It was a strange note in Nixon's parting words at the White House. Alice Roosevelt urged him to say it, but she also said, "When they ask me, what do I think about his using those lines, I'll tell them it was ridiculous, vulgar, whatever. It'll be an intense pleasure to lie to the Washington Post." That's one thing, she tells Nixon, that you and I share.
This encounter is fictional.
I wondered.
Didn't happen. But in fact, when Nixon did use that line at the time, people did think it was sort of strange to compare the loss of his presidency to Teddy Roosevelt's loss of his young wife, Alice's mother, in 1884. And they went to Alice, and they said, "What did you think of that?" And she said something very dismissive that I thought it was quite inappropriate, so forth and so on. But again, working as a novelist, I tried to imagine a way in which that quote that she gives to the paper was in fact a kind of signal between her and Nixon, because they had actually talked about it before, and that she had gone to buck him up, you know, in his darkest hour. I don't think that happened, but what a historian always has to strive for is accuracy. What a novelist always has to strive for is just plausibility. And if you can impose the illusion of plausibility, then you're okay. Obviously, as a historian, you've got to do much more than that.
Maybe the biggest leap you take in this book, Tom Mallon, is an amazing speech from Pat Nixon, late into the Troubles. But Nixon tells her, as you've recounted in the thing, that he had called Jacqueline Kennedy mm-hmm. on that morning and spoken to her. It was an anniversary of...
10th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination.
Exactly. And that's a marvelous dialogue back and forth. But later in the day, he tells Pat Nixon, "I called Jackie Kennedy today." And Pat Nixon sort of stews on this for a little bit and then comes back at him. And I wish you'd read this. It's an amazing speech. And we don't need to be told that this is fiction, but I wonder how you did it.
Well, Pat Nixon, who's treated very sympathetically in the book, she feels this anger toward Nixon building up. She hated politics. Her happiest time was the period in the 1960s that Nixon referred to as his wilderness years, you know, when he'd lost the presidency, lost the governorship of California, and he's plotting his comeback. Those were happy years for her. She was a prosperous Republican lawyer's wife. They lived on Fifth Avenue. She went to bookstores. She went to museums. Her girls were in school. She went to Elizabeth Arden. It was the kind of life that she might have had in Pasadena if they had never gotten into politics. And then, of course, she has the whole tumult of his presidency, and she sees it crumbling. And she has a lot of anger toward him, along with a lot of loyalty toward him. And before this scene, for months, she feels this anger building up toward him, and she knows she has to get it out. And once it is out, she knows then she will stick with him toward the end. But she does discharge this blast at him, and I imagine it happening on Thanksgiving of 73. "You don't understand," she said, even now not raising her voice. "I know they're to blame." She didn't have to tell him who they were, the Kennedys and everyone else who'd made him into the arch fiend since the days of Jerry Voorhees and Helen Douglas, and who'd flung five times the mud and brimstone he had. "I would have made an enemies list twice as long as yours and Colson's, and I would have done something to get the people on it, anything to be rid of them forever, the way I thought they were gone from our lives after 60, and then 62, and then, surely, at this time last year. I hate your enemies, but you love them. You love their existence. They're what gives you your own. That's why I'm sick with anger at you, for bringing us to the top of this awful mountain we're never going to get back down without being devoured." And this scene actually takes place literally on a mountain, on Catoctin Mountain, because they're at Camp David for Thanksgiving.
How sure are you of your Pat Nixon, including an affair she's having with a man that she met in Schratt's in New York, mm-hmm. in that 60s period. That, for me, I must say, was the one trip of credibility.
It's a very gentle, tender, mild affair that she has with this retired trust and estates lawyer in New York. And it's just kind of a tender memory when she's the first lady. And that affair is fiction. And Tom Garahan, who's the character, who is the man with whom she has the affair, he's one of three fictional characters in the book. The only hint is in this long dramatis personae, which lists dozens and dozens of characters. If you look at Tom Garahan and another character named Clarine Land or whatever, you'll see there are quotation marks around their names. There was one, the reviewer in the Wall Street Journal, who in many ways was quite kind to the novel, Frank Gannon, but he was he had worked in the Nixon White House, whatever, and he was not happy about the business of Mrs. Nixon having an affair and so forth. And I think it's a fair point. I mean, that's about as far into real fictionalization as I go. But I don't think I would have done it if it was, you know, for laughs. Oh, here's plastic Mrs. Nixon having an affair. And, you know, the irony of that will make everybody laugh. I certainly didn't do it for that reason. It was a way in which I felt able to imagine her more sympathetically, more truly. It was a way into her emotions for me and into her consciousness. And so in a sense, even though I was aware that such a thing probably did not happen, in a way, this may be the weasel words of the novelist, but in a way, it allowed me to use falseness to get at a more essential truth, a truth that I couldn't have gotten at if I had stuck with the facts. But these are the questions that, you know, historical fiction does raise. And obviously, the closer you are in time to what you're writing about, the more difficult it is. Somebody asked me once in an interview about that novel, Henry and Clara, about the couple in the balcony with the Lincolns. And he said to me, "Don't you fear the dead?" And I was sort of astonished by the question because it's 130 years ago or whatever it was at that time. But yes, with people who are only recently departed, you are probably playing with a greater degree of fire.
There's a wonderful moment in the book where she tells the man that she's having the affair with about Dick. He is a terrible dancer, isn't he?
Yeah, they're no longer having this affair, but they have very, very, very sporadic contact, telephone contact and so forth. And he's recalling watching Trisha Nixon's White House wedding on television. And during that wedding, there's a clip of the Nixons dancing at their daughter's wedding.
And yet there's a great tenderness there, especially in this late scene in your book where it's all over, really, for Nixon. I mean, he's going down, and he finally sort of blurts out to Pat, "Do you love me?" But you should be reading this.
I think, yeah, the only thing a reader needs to know about this is that one of the campaign slogans for his reelection was "Now More Than Ever" in 1972. And this is on the ride home from Air Force One, and he's beside himself, really, and she's trying to console him. She looked at him now, a sight so painful she couldn't conjure any image from the happier years behind them. She could only see the months ahead, the encouragements, the scoldings, the jokes and stratagems it would take to keep him alive, at home or in prison. That would be her work, and she would offer it up with whatever tenderness she had in her. It was the one thing left for her to do, and she would be worthy of it. "Do you love me?" Suddenly the words were out of him, making her flinch like a firecracker thrown during a motorcade. He wanted her to answer a question he hadn't asked in more than 30 years, since before those propeller flights that they'd just been talking about. She leaned over to kiss his forehead, trying to find words to use herself, and they came to her from all the campaign banners they had walked under 2 years ago, on their way toward this moment, this ruin. "Now more than ever," she whispered.
We could talk forever about Nixon. He is endlessly fascinating. And I must say, the appealing part of him is that in our kind of more and more programmed politics, he was absolutely incurably individual person. There's a great moment where he thinks maybe he should go down to the D.C. jail and talk to Gordon Liddy, mm-hmm. and speak to him. And Ron Ziegler says, and Ron Ziegler knew him well, The man who could go down to the Lincoln Memorial in 1970 and talk to the kids, the awful kids, might actually just do that. Mm-hmm. He had a terrific kind of countercultural courage about what he was doing. I mean, his extraordinary mind, and then his very original, impossible path.
He loved the bold move, you know, the long ball. And he loved doing these very surprising, counterintuitive things. And, of course, the main one of those things was going to China. And we have that whole phrase that entered the language, only Nixon could go to China, you know, and people adapt that phrase for when somebody does something counterintuitive and they have the credibility to get away with it. I was thinking somebody ought to write a little piece, you know, in with Santorum. I was going to call it, I was thinking of doing it myself, called Only Santorum Could Go to Hell, because, you know, I can imagine him, you know, 2 years into his administration, I will visit Satan, you know, and I will, only I can make a credible approach to him. But I think, you know, Bill Clinton spoke very eloquently at Nixon's funeral, and he said, I'm paraphrasing it and draining it of its eloquence, but it was something to the effect that the time has long since passed for us to judge Richard Nixon on anything less than the totality of his life, you know, meaning there was more to him than the archfiend of Watergate. And as I say, I don't think he would have interested me if I thought he were some two-dimensional villain. For years, I thought, Robert Caro has another volume of his Johnson biography coming out this year, and I thought, how on earth does he spend year after year, decade after decade with Johnson? I sort of had a greater understanding of that after spending the last few years with Nixon. I think I could have even gone a little longer with Nixon than I did.
You mentioned Nixon on Santorum. There's a passage in the book in the 1972 renomination convention where Nixon is talking to himself. This is your language. He can't stop thinking that the Republican Party remains the world's largest and laziest Rotary Club. If he can't get them to nominate John Conley of Texas 4 years from now, that would have been 76, he'd just as soon see a whole different party with a new name to take the GOP's place. What in the world would he be saying about this one in 2012?
Now, I think he'd be pretty appalled at what's going on now. I mean, I think he would look at these fringe figures, Santorum, to some extent Gingrich. I mean, he loved Comeback, certainly, and, you know, Gingrich has been out of office for many years, but I think he would look at what's actually being debated and would roll his eyes over the trivia of it all. I mean, the idea that we're talking about things like contraception and so forth, I think would have turned him off completely. Nixon, who had a very liberal domestic program, fundamentally was not that interested in domestic affairs, period. He thought the country could run itself. I mean, I think there was almost a Coolidge aspect to him there. He was perfectly happy to have the government do things, and he increased funding for the arts enormously. He was for the federal government providing health insurance, guaranteed annual income, all of these things. But fundamentally, I don't think that stuff interested him. He viewed the presidency as the office from which the foreign policy of the United States was executed. There's one story that he said to Mitchell around the time of the first inauguration, soon to be sworn, and he said, you be president, I'll be secretary of state. And I think that's how he viewed the office. He had a very definite domestic program, a much more liberal domestic program in most respects, more liberal than Bill Clinton's or even Barack Obama's. But I think it's a measure of how tumultuous those times were, that all of that is so subordinated in our memories to the agonies over the war and then the tremendous exhilaration over his approaches to Russia and to China. I just think he'd be disgusted with the trivia of the campaign now. And I do think he had lost interest in the Republican Party. I mean, the way presidents often do, they don't campaign for people far down the ticket, you know, and his 72 victory was a kind of a one-man show.
So what do you suppose he might be talking about? You make me think he'd be speaking in sort of in the voice of Henry Kissinger, writing vast books on China or a new world of Eastern powers or the question of American decline. He would be saying some obvious patriotic Republican Party kinds of things, but he'd also be thinking hard about it.
I think Nixon would be telling the candidates now, why are we not spending the hour we have available to us in this debate talking about what's going on in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia and Syria? Let's get serious, you know? And, I mean, he famously said to Barbara Walters once when she asked him something about his feelings, and he said, you know, I don't want to get into that kind of nonsense. Let's get serious. Let's move on, you know, to a real issue. And I think he thought, too, toward the end, that what he had been accomplishing on the world stage would finally save him. In October of 73, the month of the Saturday Night Massacre, he really is instrumental in saving Israel, which has its back to the sea. The Arabs have a tremendous military advantage at the beginning of the war. Nixon overrules his advisors and State Department and Defense Department and says, get everything into the air, and essentially saves Israel. But the minute he does, he begins putting pressure on the Israelis, now's your chance to make a settlement. And Sadat is so impressed by that that he throws the Russians out of Egypt. And the Russians had a tremendous military presence in Egypt. And Sadat decides, I think it's America who's the honest broker in this region. So Nixon has invitations in June of 74 to go to Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Syria, and Saudi Arabia. No American president since could get that kind of dance card. And I think it's Nixon's last foreign trip. He's really endangering his life by going. His phlebitic leg, could send a clot to his heart, whatever. But I think that he had to have been thinking at the time that if I can somehow pull off a basic settlement in the Middle East after the Paris Peace Accords ending Vietnam, after my China opening, after the arms agreement with Russia, they will not be able to bring themselves to throw me out of office over Watergate. But, you know, time ran out for him.
Come back to this matter of fiction that is more real than life. Henry James deeply believed it was more vital than what we go through every day. So many of the best lines in your book are what would be called gaffes, when people, politicians especially, say what's actually on their minds.
Right.
And so much of our journalism is the other stuff. What would it take to make our political discourse somewhat more like the reality that you reveal? I kept thinking as I read this book, American politics and the people that do it is so damned interesting. But why do we have to wait 40 years for a creative fiction guy to tell us how interesting it actually was?
I mean, to add to Henry James, D.H. Lawrence calls the novel the one bright book of life, you know, and I think it's a way of imagining people. But I think in some ways we're going to need to resort to it more and more, because if you look at our political scene versus Nixon's 40 years ago, language is more sterile, more scripted. Politicians never have a natural moment in public anymore. For one thing, they know that everybody's got an iPhone taping them, they're taking their pictures, whatever. There are no semi-private moments, that there used to be.
Right.
And the language gets continually worse, continually more bland. And it's an extremely unnatural profession. And politicians themselves are much more robotic than they used to be. How does one imagine somebody like Lyndon Johnson operating in a culture like today? You know, the rawness and the energy and so forth, or Nixon. So I think that for any understanding of what's really going on inside them, I think it's probably going to require more novelists taking more liberties to get at it.
You did it so beautifully in this book. I can't quite do justice to how I've enjoyed it and how I admire your work. Thank you, Thomas Mallon. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.